Finally, when discussing other countries' perception of the United States, Bush said, "If we're an arrogant nation, they'll resent us. If we're a humble nation, but strong, they'll welcome us." Our nation stands alone right now in the world in terms of power, and that's why we've got to be humble. We should be proud and confident in our values, but humble in how we treat nations that are figuring out how to chart their own course. In other words, President Bush ran and won on a very different foreign policy from the one we are told all Republicans must support. We know what came later, of course, and by the 2008 Republican primaries, one of the frontrunners had strayed so far from President Bush's original platform that he was even saying that in the future, nation building should become one of the standard functions of the American military. Some Americans may be familiar with the admonition of John Quincy Adams that America does not go abroad in search of monsters to destroy. But his sentiments extended well beyond this oft-cited maxim. First, Adams considered what could be said in America's defense if anyone were ever to wonder what she had done for the world. If the wise and learned philosophers of the elder world should find their hearts disposed to inquire, what has America done for the benefit of mankind? Let our answer be this. America, with the same voice which spoke herself into existence as a nation, proclaimed to mankind the inextinguishable rights of human nature and the only lawful foundation of government. America, in the assembly of nations, since her admission among them, has invariably, though often fruitlessly, held forth to them the hand of honest friendship, of equal freedom, of generous reciprocity. She has uniformly spoken among them, though often to heedless and often to disdainful ears, the language of equal liberty, of equal justice, and of equal rights. She has, in the lapse of nearly a half a century, without a single exception, respected the independence of other nations while asserting and maintaining her own. She has abstained from interference in the concerns of others, even when the conflict has been for principles to which she clings as to the last vital drop that visits the heart. Adams then described the foreign policy of the American Republic. Wherever the standard of freedom and independence has been or shall be unfurled, there will her heart, her benedictions, and her prayers be. But she goes not abroad in search of monsters to destroy. She is the well-wisher to the freedom and independence of all. She is the champion and vindicator only of her own. She will commend the general cause by the countenance of her voice and the benignant sympathy of her example. She well knows that by once enlisting under other banners than her own, were they even the banners of foreign independence, she would involve herself beyond the power of extrication in all the wars of interest and intrigue, of individual avarice, envy, and ambition, which assume the colors and usurp the standard of freedom. The fundamental maxims of her policy would insensibly change from liberty to force. She might become the dictatress of the world. She would be no longer the ruler of her own spirit. This was an isolationism. It was a beautiful and elegant statement of common sense and of principles that at one time were taken for granted by nearly everyone. In the same way, Henry Clay was merely repeating George Washington's wise sentiments rather than giving voice to isolationism when he urged this piece of advice upon his countrymen. By the policy to which we have adhered since the days of Washington, we have done more for the cause of liberty than arms could effect. We have shown to other nations the way to greatness and happiness. Far better is it for ourselves and the cause of liberty that adhering to our Pacific system and avoiding the distant wars of Europe, we should keep our lamp burning brightly on the western shore as a light to all nations than to hazard its utter extinction amid the ruins of fallen and falling republics in Europe. Thus, we should strive to lead by example rather than force, and provide a model for the world that other peoples will wish to follow. We do no one any good by bankrupting ourselves. Richard Cobden was a 19th century British statesman who opposed all of his government's foreign interventions. In those days, though, people understood the philosophy of non-intervention much better than they do today, and no one was silly enough to brand Cobden an isolationist. He was known instead, appropriately enough, as the International Man. There are those who condemn non-interventionists for being insufficiently ambitious, for their unwillingness to embrace national greatness, as if a nation's greatness could be measured according to any calculus other than the virtues of its people and the excellence of its institutions. These critics should have the honesty to condemn the founding fathers for the same defect. They wouldn't dare, but it would be refreshing to hear it stated in so many words. Our current political class is blessed with historic genius, and Jefferson, Washington, and Madison were contemptible fools.